before I started the theme proper, the delight of the divine, I think I should make a kind of confession which would give you a clue as to what has led me to the acceptance of the truth of the delight of God. Ever since my childhood, I always conceived of God life, spiritual life, as something austere, serious, solemn. I can't say what made me think that way, but the fact remains that I have not been alone. Most of the traditions in India have been in this line. I am not very conversant with the traditions in the West, mystic or spiritual traditions in the West. But by and large, I grew up in the Indian tradition, looking upon spiritual life as something where one does not laugh over much, enjoy over much. In fact, enjoyment is a taboo. And since this aspiration for God, to realize God, to see God face to face, had been in a way implanted in my childhood, I grew up in the light of these mental formations, with the result that in my school days or college days, I was always looked upon as a sort of a killjoy, though all were not brutal enough to say that to my face. But I knew if my friends, if my roommates in the hostel would think of going to the pictures, I would ostentatiously say, no, I won't join. And I remember I would derive a perverse satisfaction of having denied myself something with the supposed gain from the spiritual point of view. It didn't occur to me at that time that even to feel that I was denying myself something was a blemish that showed there was a secret attraction in rejecting which I had what we would say in our terms today, a vital satisfaction. Be that as it may, this continued to feel serious, to look serious, to look down upon those who habitually look to the lighter side of things, laugh, joke, enjoy themselves, picnic, games, pictures, and in a thousand other ways. And I was 19 when I first came here. It was after I saw Mother that my soul first wept and wept. So much so that the whole assembly in the hall where pranam was going on, they were moved and they asked my mentor as to what had happened. He had a job in explaining things to them. But that was the last. Thereafter, my soul started smiling. Suddenly I realized that laughter, cheerfulness, joy was more natural, brought one more into proximity with the Divine than all solemnity, seriousness that I could cultivate or summon. I asked my teacher whether all that I had thought was wrong, because my experience here testified to the contrary. He told me that it was not altogether wrong, but I would know as I would grow. And indeed, I have been learning every day that the truth is neither in complete solemnity or seriousness, nor in unceasing cheerfulness or delight. Underneath the flow of delight issuing from the Divine, there is a profound awareness of the truth. The seriousness and the solemnity which certain traditions seem to foster made one detach oneself from involvement in the petty rounds of lower nature, ignorance, and look to another side of life. There is truth in both, but the fact is that the easier door to the Divine is delight, joy, rather than dryness, solemnity. Here again, there is the joy and joy, delight and delight. There is a delight which needs a cause, which thrives as long as the cause is in operation. When the cause is withdrawn, the delight falls. This is called the vital jar, a movement of the vital part in the being. But there is an uncaused jar, an uncaused bliss which does not depend upon outer stimulation. It is self-existent. The more one breaks out of the shell of self-centeredness and throws oneself expansively, one breathes the vibrations of joy, of felicity. The more one digs in and breaks through the veils of travail of emotions entangled in ignorance, and approaches nearer the soul, what mother calls the psychic, there is a flow, an outflow of bubbling joy. There is no apparent reason why it should be there. One just feels happy. The other day I was asked by a colleague, when he woke up that morning, he had a quiet happiness, a felicitous feeling. It was obvious, it was a psychic movement. If it was not psychic, if it was vital, one surely knows the reason that has stimulated this simulacrum of delight. The delight, I would put it this way, as one grows more and more natural, as one finds one's base, natural base, in the divine within or the divine around, the founts of bliss open up. That is because bliss, delight, joy are inalienable characteristics of the divine. In yoga, the aim is, we have seen, the union of the soul with the divine that exists, the divine that is conscious, the divine that is blissful. Human nature is progressively cultured and developed in its consciousness so that it first reflects, thereafter it links itself with the higher, the divine nature. And how it realizes the divine nature depends upon the approach that one makes. If one thinks of the divine as peace, one eventually realizes the divine as peace. Think of the divine as pure consciousness, the divine reveals itself to you as consciousness. Conceive of the divine, cultivate the divine as delight, and the divine will reveal itself in waves of delight. In fact, according to our approach is the response. There is an old controversy in the Upanishads, and these controversies will always be there as human mind speculates, or as long as it is in the stage of speculation. For instance, whether existence was earlier or non-existent. Then a seer in the Upanishad asks, it is very well to put this question, but how can existence come out of non-existence? How can anything proceed out of nothing? Similarly, in another context, one of the Upanishads declares that if one thinks of the Brahman of the Divine as the existent, one verily becomes the existent. If one thinks of the Divine as non-existent, one ends up by becoming non-existent. And that is, after all, what happened with the Buddhist philosophers. They started picturing, we do not know what exactly Buddha did, but the Buddhist philosophers started thinking, conceiving, and speaking of the ultimate as annihilation. And as they built themselves by spiritual disciplines in the image of their ideal, they started cancelling themselves, with the result that a successful culmination of their life, yogic life, was to cancel themselves into a giant nihilism. So the point is, as we conceive, as we approach the Divine, so is the self-revelation of the Divine. To the seeker of the integral yoga, the Divine is not only approachable, not only conceivable, but approached in all ways. The Divine is sought after through knowledge in its conscious existence. The Divine is sought after in its power and will through work. The Divine is sought after in his aspect of delight, through love, through devotion. Each way, each path sets a certain objective before itself and pursues it through its characteristic means. There is the way of knowledge, there is the way of works, there is the way of love. But Sri Aurobindo points out that of all, the way of love, the way of delight, is the most all-embracing. Because when we approach the Divine true knowledge, we inevitably start by separating ourselves from what we conceive to be the not the Divine. We discriminate, we reject what is not, in our opinion or in our tradition, not the Divine, eliminate things, narrow our focus and fix ourselves on our idea of what the Divine is. Gradually, personalities, forms, individuals, they lose their importance because we see them passing. Men pass, man remains. Hours and seconds pass, but the time remains. So everywhere, in every field, as our faculty of discrimination works, we tend to eliminate from our vision forms and units and our knowledge tends to be impersonal. Similarly, but we cannot forget that the impersonal is not the whole of the divine existence. There is also the personal aspect claiming our attention, demanding our allegiance. Similarly, in the way of works, we tune ourselves, we place our will in obedience to our ideal of the divine will. An impersonal will, a will of the Lord active in the universe. We place ourselves as instruments and work in consecration. It is inevitable that once we start working in this way, once we bring in the concept of disinterested service and work, a certain attitude of detachment, of an impersonal instrument, takes possession of us. And the personal aspect is relegated to the background. But in the way of delight, things are different. Indeed, there are religions who worship God as delight, as joy, in order to arrive at the paradise of the joy of God. But a yogin does not. He does not take to the way of love to win anything for himself. He does not love God in order that God must love him. He does it for his own sake. As mother once said to me, that one loves because one can't help loving. It is the nature of love to flow out. There is no calculation. There is no bargaining. One just loves because one has to love. With the divine, particularly, one pours out only in order to roll out one's delight, one's joy, one's love at the feet of the divine. That the divine responds tenfold is another matter. But one does not start in the yoga of love with an eye to the quantum of response from the divine. Pursued in this way, pursued in utter abandon, this way of love, which takes on the character of the way of delight after it is established, as it develops, one finds that both the ways of knowledge and of work are only forms or the culminations of the yoga of love. As one loves and goes on loving more and more, one comes to know more and more of the divine being around whom our whole love is centered. The more one loves, the more one knows. The more one knows, one can't help loving more, because one realizes that the divine is oneself. And one loves just as a fact, not as a discipline. Similarly, a God lover does not in this path shut himself always in ecstatic communion with his beloved. Love demands to be expressed. It insists on radiating itself. It pours itself on those around, on service, on works. Works come out of one as scintillating radiations of love. One loves not to get purified will, not to get liberation, but because one has become an instrument, and a loving instrument that cherishes the power of the Lord that runs through him. One is conscious that the force that works, the strength that sustains, is of the Lord, is of the divine. And one throws oneself with utter abandon in transmuting this love energy into works. So the way of love at its depth, at its height, reveals itself as a culmination, as the way of knowledge, way of work, in excelsis. Necessarily, for an integral seeker, the divine is not merely transcendent. The divine is present in the universe, not less than in himself. The divine is indeed present in the individual. He is present beyond, but he is also present in the universe. And his love, his delight in embracing the divine, is not full, not complete, until he embraces the divine spread out in the universe. The whole universe is looked upon and experienced as the body of God. He sees the same divine which is at work in him, also at work in the universe, in the innumerable creatures that people the universe. The only difference is that he is aware, he is conscious that the divine is active in him, is manifesting in him. The others are blissfully ignorant. They are not aware. In their egoism, in their limited vision, they tend to think that they are acting, they are doing. But the God lover knows from where the hidden springs of life are moved. His vision sees what the men in the universe do not. And he tunes himself to the all lover who plays in a million bodies. That is not all. The fruit of the light is love. One can experience love on the wings of the light. It is joy that leads to the source of love. Of a reminiscence told by mother in Psalm 1923, 50 years ago. She said that it was, all this happened when she was 12 or 13. She was living with her grandmother. And she did not know at that time, though she was in France, anything about physical love. Love between man and woman, she did not know. One day it happened that some distant relations of her grandmother, who was a strict moralist, they came to their house. And when mother entered the drawing room, she found them. It was a boy and a girl. She said the girl was sitting on the lap of the boy. And they were vigorously kissing each other. For mother, it did not make any meaning. She says it was just a scene for me, like a film, a scene. She watched. Then she says she found that they were deriving some joy in the process. And as she was wondering, she says, suddenly there was an eruption of joy in herself and her whole being expanded. It was only later that she came to know that what was going on was a part of physical love. The point is, the element of joy that burst in her without the starting point of physical love, which operates in most human beings. So I was saying that delight leads to love, true love. And the acme of love is to see beauty in what one loves. It is a joke, all right, at the human level, to say that one sees beauty where one's love is centered. But behind it, there is a great truth. One discovers beauty. Because through love, one establishes a link, a certain identity which breaks through the surface appearances. So to the God lover, God is not only present in the universe around, but He is present as the all-beautiful. Everything puts on an appearance of beauty. One thrills to the presence of beauty everywhere, maybe in a flower, maybe in a grasshopper, maybe in an insect, an animal, a domestic, anyone who would not normally draw two glances. One awakes to the presence of the all-beautiful Godhead. This is the acme of the delight of the divine, to see the divine as beauty at every level of creation. to the extent that we are unable to appreciate beauty in nature, beauty in the universe, beauty in those around us, we are steeped in ignorance. As we grow, we awake to this omnipresent truth of the divine as the beautiful in the universe. Someone could ask any question.
My mother was seeing visions of one who she called Krishna. How did the vision start? At what age and in what form did she talk?
I believe it must have been after she was 14, 13 or 14. She mentions that a number of spiritual teachers used to come and give guidance to her during what she takes care to describe as the body sleep. And of them, there was one person, one personality, which was constant. And she learned to call him Krishna. Now whether her calling him Krishna had anything to do with the fact that after a lot of struggle and search, she ultimately managed to get hold of an imperfect translation in French of the Gita, and her knowledge of Krishna in the Gita led her to call this guide Krishna, I can't definitely say, but I believe it has some relation. And for the person, the teacher whom she was calling Krishna, when she saw Sri Aurobindo for the first time, she felt intuitively and convincingly that this was the same person. And we all know that the Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita has something to do with Sri Aurobindo. No, so many times Sri Aurobindo has said that there is no difference between Krishna and himself. That is because the central Godhead that manifested one time as Krishna now manifested as Sri Aurobindo. It had manifested earlier in time as something else, even as it is going to manifest as someone else in time to come. This is what we can gather from Mother's comments and observations. It was only a few weeks ago that when I was taking down notes from Champaklal's diary, he spoke to me that a young friend of his and he, they both came together. He must have been 17 or 18, the other boy also of the same age, 50 years ago. Both came ostensibly to take yoga from Sri Aurobindo. But Champaklal found that the way Sri Aurobindo was giving him hints, telling things to him, treating him was a little different from what he was doing to the other boy, who also had come ostensibly for the same purpose. Later he found out there was a reason, because the other man was a worshipper of Krishna, and he already had a ritual, a way of worshipping that God, praying to him and all that. And for Champaklal, there was no other god except Sri Aurobindo. One day, when these two boys compared notes, the other boy got doubt whether what he was doing was wrong. So he went and asked Sri Aurobindo, "I have been worshipping Krishna all along in my house here, I love him. But I have come to you now. Is that wrong?" Sri Aurobindo told him, "No, it is not wrong, because there is no difference between me and Krishna." So it was not to Dilip only that he wrote that, but it is a fact. Similarly, in his letters defending Rama against strictures of certain modern authors about his behavior in the Ramayana, Sri Aurobindo observed somewhere "I have a duty to defend Rama." It means something of him was there. And he felt obliged to explain Rama's conduct. He did it very well. One of the charges against Rama was that while fighting with the monkey king, who forgot to keep his promise to help search the stolen Sita, Rama was fighting the monkey king who had usurped the kingdom of his brother. He was a powerful chieftain, and Rama found he could not kill him by the usual means. So he adopted a stratagem which, to our modern conceptions and standards, looks unchivalrous, unheroic, and he killed him. So the charge was, how could a manifestation of God, that Rama was, adopt this unfair means? Sri Aurobindo's answer was, who is to decide what is fair and unfair? What is fair today was not fair 1,000 years ago. Besides, when you have to deal with an enemy who is infrahuman, you have necessarily to allow means that are infrahuman. You have to meet the enemy on his plane. So he said there was nothing wrong in his adopting infrahuman means to kill an infrahuman enemy. Obviously, mothers meeting Sri Aurobindo on the physical plane meant the beginning of the manifestation that was intended at the present epoch of the new consciousness, the new truth, the divine consciousness that was to manifest, descended for purposes of manifestation into two forms. It is an occult truth that wherever there is manifestation, there has to be a polarity. There has to be two ends, two poises, the positive and the negative, the static and the dynamic. Translated in human terms, the male and the female. So this one consciousness took human form as a man in the East, woman in the West, symbolizing that both the East and the West had to come together to make the manifestation meaningful and complete. Mother observed once that her taking birth in France had a special meaning because she had to undergo a special education. Otherwise, everything in her was Indian. She had often declared herself to be Indian first. But she had to be born there in order to equip herself for the world with the best that the Western civilization had to contribute. They had, once things were ready, things had been revealed to Sri Aurobindo in terms of knowledge and his consciousness was ready. Mother's occult personality with all the power and spiritual consciousness embodied in her, they were mature, both came together, and the first result was the starting of the Arya, which established in the human mind for all time the positive ideal of human perfection and divine life. It sought to work out this vision, this ideal, in terms of individual perfection, collective perfection, applied it in the different fields of life, and for 7 years, or 6.5 to 7 years, this journal continued, by the end of which the ashram started to form. The decisive starting point for the entire project was on the 29th of March 1914, when the mother met Sri Aurobindo. And Sri Aurobindo became convinced on seeing mother that what he had perceived and he was trying for, the complete surrender of the human to the divine, to the last self, that he saw concretely realized in the mother, that opened a new page to him and to mother. The first sight of Sri Aurobindo was a guarantee that in spite of all the appearances to the contrary, the hour of liberation, the hour of salvation from ignorance and inconscience was at hand. mother is doing intensely what she had been doing when she was in the physical body. But on a larger canvas, her work has spread out, become more effective, because in the subtler body in which she is functioning now, the supramental consciousness and the will and the force are able to effectuate themselves more concretely than ever before. It is only certain distant results of this working on the subtler planes that are glimpsed by some in their psychic experiences, dreams or visions, or in their day-to-day life. But she has been tremendously active, quickening the aspiration in everyone, assuring everyone of her ever-present guidance in some form or other, each one feeling that she is specially present in him and for him, opening up all avenues in the on earth that could possibly respond to the pressure of the higher consciousness, forcing out things that have to be weeded out, precipitating crisis after crisis so as to bring out what was hidden, exposing untruths, ugliness, in order that they may be got rid of once for all, so that the hour of the divine manifestation may be brought nearer and nearer. Friend Bhakta is here. I have been reproducing some of his experiences in the form of letters or diary notes in the service letter, deliberately in answer to questions like these. He would tell you how the mother has been more active, more completely present in the atmosphere than ever before. At any rate, during the last 1 year, all that most of us knew was mother was ailing. Mother's body was in pain. Today we can't think of it. We think of her as a vibrant presence, a dynamic power at work everywhere, making one smile and look up, giving the confidence that in spite of all the mess that we have created, we are going to get through. Whether it is Auroville or ashram, the day of glory is bound to come. Because she is there, she is at work. All those who cannot sustain her work, who cannot respond to her force, will be weeded out. If not today, tomorrow. If not tomorrow, the day after. Only those who can respond, who can carry the charge, they will be left, and more will join them.